Chapter 26, August 2057. The Edinburgh Conference ended without any more significant meetings between mother and son. Jan and she. Jan's handlers seemed to see to that. But another opportunity of sorts for a rapprochement came up a month later. For by then, Wu Yan was participating in another exotic lunar manufacturing experiment, and this time on Earth. And to Tasha's initial surprise, in the Americas, on a plateau in Oregon called the High Lava Plains. But the American Free States government had responded positively to a Chinese request for resources, partly for political advantage, particularly over its rival, the Rump US, and also for the chance of learning about the Chinese experiments themselves. And the AFS too saw an advantage in getting Wu Yan out there, for political leverage. For publicity through imagery featuring her own now familiar face against an American background. So Tash and Mel started to work out an itinerary to get Xi out to Oregon. Officially, he was to be a kind of goodwill ambassador from the American hosts of the Chinese project, one the Chinese would find hard to turn away. Unofficially, as far as Tash could see, he was being used yet again as a sort of out-in-the-open spy on his mother's project. It was becoming a pattern, Tash thought. It's a long shot, she told a sceptical Mel, but it's cheap and it's worth a try. In the end, an invitation was forthcoming, over Wu Yan's signature. Though, in the end, and to Tasha's intense disappointment, she would not be present herself on the day. Mel herself was sent out in advance to find her way around the facility. Then Tash followed with Xi. And as it turned out, to complicate everything, the meeting was to take place on the very day the surviving crew of the Almirik, the jeopardized Mars mission, were due, at last, 4 months late, to return to Earth. But maybe that was a good thing, Mel and Tash decided. If things went bad, or even if they went well, there couldn't be a better day for Xi to be with the in-jokes. If not his mother. Tash had a very hard time trying to read how Xi felt about that absence. On the day itself, after a very early start, a Jones Inc. shuttle plane carrying Tash and Xi descended from an iron-hot sky to land at the Chinese experimental site. It was a little before midday, local. As they waited on the plane while its engines closed down, Tash could see Mel herself emerging from a small white dome of a shelter. Wearing a broad-brimmed hat against the strength of the sun, she walked alone to the plane. There was little else to see. This so-called high lava plain really was just a plain, a kilometre and a half above sea level, thrust into a blue dome of sky, free of cloud, a rare sight in a world of turbulent post-blink weather. The setup itself was largely automated, Tash knew. She saw a few buildings nearby, scattered bits of machinery, evidently components of the test rig. But further out there seemed to be more complex knots of machinery, more activity. Tash thought she glimpsed movement, slow, deliberate, enigmatic. Not a human in sight. Space manufacturing technology brought to this strange corner of the Earth. She, in the seat beside her, was staring into a screen. Tash glimpsed scrolling readouts, a sketchy cartoon of a stub-winged spacecraft high above the curve of the Earth. A couple of human faces, their talk too soft for Tash to make out the words. The surviving astronauts of the Almirik, talking to their mission controllers, their capcoms. The day's other priority. She seemed aware of nothing else. Not even the fact that the plane had landed, maybe. Tash tentatively reached out to him. Hey, we're down. Mel is coming. They just ejected, the lander, I mean, from the rest of the complex, the shelter. He tapped to bring up the clock, on time just after 9 a.m, local time here. Now they only have the service module for last-minute tweaks to the trajectory. The service module was a small propulsion unit, Tash knew. So, she said, they're falling towards re-entry. Falling into the air of Earth in a landing module that looked, in the images Tash had seen, like the mutant offspring of an Apollo command module, a squat cone atop a thick heat shield, but with stubby space shuttle black and white wings. The lander was an emergency lifeboat that should never have been needed. The original mission plan had been for the whole remaining stack, shelter and all, to be decelerated smoothly into Earth orbit, and then docked with one of the low orbit stations up there, tucked safely inside Earth's magnetosphere. Well, the blink had put paid to that plan. After drifting off course, for a whole day without solar gravity, the crew had had to burn up most of their remaining fuel to correct the ship's course, and had used their emergency-only solar sail to get a little more deflection. The remnant ship had at last reached Earth. But with not enough fuel left to slow up sufficiently to make orbit, to achieve a docking. And so now, desperately, the surviving astronauts, like the wounded Apollo 13 crew on the way back from the moon, were just going to have to hurtle direct into the atmosphere and lose their final kinetic energy to friction from the air of Earth. Tash had been surprised to learn that this particular lander had made the trip to Mars and back twice before, without needing to be used. A high-tech lifeboat, emergency only. Now its time had come, and already this veteran of space was falling down through the sky of Earth. Tash knew there would be few such missions in the near future. For in the face of the Galaxias crisis, the multinational Curiosity base on Mars was being mothballed, its crew returned home. "We won't see anything from here, will we? I know that's naive." She shook his head curtly. "Not from here. And nowhere for an hour, maybe more, before they hit the atmosphere." She took his hand. "That hour's going to seem like a year. Let's get out of here. Come see Mel." She scrambled out first. Tash, emerging from the plane, stood at the top of a mobile stair, cautious in the brilliant light, and immediately aware of the thinness of the dry air. She took her time, breathed deep, looked around. She faced a stark landscape, a flat plain of brownish pebbles and dust. The human presence was slight. Nearby, that huddle of buildings, evidently what passed for an air terminal here. Small clusters of enigmatic bits of machinery, perhaps waiting to be deployed or else flown out. And in the distance, that more complex sight, at its heart Tash glimpsed what looked like a pool of black tarmac on the ground. And humans or not, there was motion everywhere, if slow, ponderous. Robots, evidently. Several squat, complex, truck-like machines were rolling and digging and scraping in the dirt. Around that central black circle, she saw now, a kind of spiral groove expanded out into the bare landscape, evidently being dug out by the machines. Save for Mel coming from her domed shelter, no humans were visible. Though there were more domes scattered across the landscape, brilliant white, with red cross markers on their flanks, relief stations presumably. Drones flitted everywhere, insectile faintly buzzing. Away from this complex, she could see nothing else for kilometres, out to a horizon only slightly dust-obscured. All very enigmatic, she thought, as she cautiously descended the stair. An enigmatic Chinese space tech experiment being run in the heart of North America. But that wasn't so strange anymore. In the wake of the blink, Tash knew, having burrowed herself through the dusty heart of the government system, that the major nations were actually communicating and cooperating pretty effectively. Even inward-looking China. Even nations in relative turmoil, like the US and its secessionist offspring, as were international agencies from the FIS and subordinate agencies on down, including NHSA, the space agency. And even now Chinese vessels, ships, and planes and satellites were very visibly helping with the monitoring of the approach of the stricken Mars ship, basically an outcome of an American project, as it headed for a hopeful splashdown in the South Pacific. Cautious cooperation then, when it really counted. Tash hoped it stayed that way in the coming months and years, but then she knew. She always had been an optimist. At last she reached the ground, following Xi. As she moved out of the shadow of the plane, the sunlight seemed to hit hard, not in terms of heat, but brilliance. She flinched and scrabbled for sunglasses, and when she breathed, she found she gasped a little, even after the mild exertion of the stair. She was reminded of times when she had landed in Denver and felt a similar high-altitude breathlessness getting off the plane. At the foot of the stair, Mel stood waiting for them. She was wearing a dust-streaked coverall, a broad hat, and a healthy layer of sunblock cream. Here. She handed over wide-brimmed hats like her own. Welcome to the guided tour. By the world's worst guide. Is this the strangest place we three ever got together? And I've been here a couple of days already, lucky me. Tash took her hat gratefully. She took his in kind of resentful silence, though he put it on. Mel smiled. Just be easy on yourselves for a while. Remember, you're a mile high. As our American hosts insist on measuring it, the air is thin and the sun strong, especially given the damage done to the stratosphere and ozone layer. We shouldn't stand around in the light. In fact, I'm the only person live on site today. The regulars fly down to safer locations when they can. No Wuyan, Tash said. No Wuyan. Not yet. Not as far as we know. The machines do everything, after all. Well, that's the idea. So it may seem a little quiet to you. I take it you don't need any comfort breaks before. She growled. That whole damn flight was a comfort break. This day is a comfort break, isn't it? Let's just get on with it. And he marched straight for the enigmatic manufacturing complex, his exoskeleton creaking. Mel and Tash shared a glance and followed him. This is probably as good as it gets, Tash murmured softly as they walked. Mel shrugged. At least he's here. They walked along a broad road of little more than compressed rubble, Tash saw, laid over a landscape that was itself pretty much rubble, with only a few of what looked like desert flowers to break the crimson monotony. Pretty rugged place, Tash said. And old, she called over his shoulder. Not much has happened here since the Miocene 5 million years ago. I looked it up. When the line that would lead to humanity was still splitting off from a whole gaggle of ape types around the world. And just about then, a big geological event right here. Correct, Mel said. A huge magmatic eruption. It created immense basaltic domes, which were then eroded to rubble, and the remains were uplifted by even more heroic geological forces to this altitude. So the result? A lava beach higher than some mountains. Earth really is a remarkable planet. She kicked a rogue pebble off the road surface. And this particular bit of it is very useful for the Chinese. Basalt pebbles, dust, dry as a bone, rich in aluminium, among other things, under that thin air. I think I get it, Tash said. I'm no scientist, remember. I just have to listen to scientists, and some of it sticks. That's why the Chinese came here. Because it's like the moon. It even feels like it's halfway to the moon. Geologically, yes, Mel said. We can't replicate lunar conditions on Earth, not on any scale anyhow. The vacuum, the low gravity and so on. But this place is a reasonable facsimile in terms of the rocks underfoot, at least. And the intense sunlight, the aridity. So here, the Chinese are trying out new industrial techniques for eventual transfer to the moon. And indeed other rocky worlds, proceeding step by step towards the goal. Just like Jones Inc., Tash put in. Right, she? You bend my ear about your methodology often enough, step by step, each step another design decision validated. But he didn't take the bait, or wasn't listening. Marching along, he was staring into his phone. Mel, following with Tash, glanced at her own phone. Tash asked, No news from space. Not really, Mel said. Still a while before the entry begins. They've gone quiet, the crew. They are committed now. All they can do is wait until they fall into the air and hope they got it right. For as Tash knew well enough by now, as the whole world did, if the lander came down at too steep an angle, it would plunge too fast into the atmosphere and burn up. But too shallow an angle, and it might just skip off like a stone bouncing from the surface of a pond and fly back into deep space. Tash knew that options had been explored for reaching the crew even so, by sending some kind of fast mission after them. But the best estimates were that the crew's consumables would be exhausted long before such a retrieval could be made. All they can do is wait, Mel said again. And that's all you can do, she. Come see your mother's latest toys. They walked on. So, Tash said as brightly as she could, the Chinese project, then, step by step. Indeed, they seemed to be developing and testing a suite of new technologies, new designs, even new ways of thinking about machines. The stuff here on this basaltic plain on Earth, even the rigs on the moon itself, are testbeds, development sites, to allow the work to develop further, to reach the ultimate goal. She glared over his shoulder at her. What ultimate goal? Nobody seems to know. Outside of the Beijing high-ups, anyhow. Fear of failure, is it? Well, call it academic caution. She just laughed. Not politics at all, then. We, under Serena Jones, have done it all out in the open from the beginning. Tash grunted. Oh, come on, she. Not all of it. As far as I know, you haven't even said where you're going yet. Well, the American nations do continue to operate a capitalist economy, Tash. There is such a thing as commercial confidentiality. So we hold details back. We have said what we are trying to do. We are emulating Pioneer 10. We are pushing out of the solar system with a crewed craft. The whole world knows that. Where is the Chinese? Where is the Chinese, perhaps? Mel said with a smile. Are waiting until they have something that works before bragging about it. Anyhow, this isn't a commercial competition, she. But if it were, Serena is at a disadvantage. Because fewer people will want to buy an edge-of-the-solar-system space drive, no matter how advanced, than efficient extraterrestrial industrial technology. Now she looked around at the installation they were approaching with, it seemed to Tash, an academic kind of curiosity that overrode even his other tensions, if briefly. Mel just smiled. I knew that would hook you. Come, let me show you. Mel walked them up to the edge of a spiral ditch that in turn enclosed that sprawling black oil slick. They stood just inside the shade of a big sagging canopy. To Tasha's mild relief, one of the structures she had spotted from the plane, she looked around, machines toiling around the periphery, digging trenches, moving dirt. The buzz of drones overhead. She felt bewildered at the sprawling scale, the slow, patient movement everywhere. She tried to observe it, component by component, imagining debriefs to come. The black slick turned out to be a kind of pavement, jet-black blocks of some hard rock, larger than household bricks, fitting together with what looked like microscopic precision. And at the far side of the pavement, she saw a spidery machine setting down more blocks, one at a time, in a dead straight trench cut in the dirt. Beyond that, she thought she saw more movement, a spray of dirt and small fragments thrown in the air. Another machine, digging a trench for the next line of bricks. Away from the pavement itself, beyond the toiling bricklayer and the digger, she saw other enigmatic structures, robots moving slowly, some on wheels or rollers, others on spindly, spidery legs, all handling stuff, picking it up, putting it down. And at one location, she saw what looked like a miniature factory, a few meters on a side. Toy-like trucks, themselves loaded by other digger machines, rolled up to dump dirt into a hopper on one side of the factory unit. Meanwhile, on the other side of the factory, metallic bars were extruded, to be carried away by still more truck-like machines. There was something intriguing, if somehow disturbing, about all this autonomous, apparently leaderless work. Perhaps it was like an ant colony. And yet she was prepared to bet that the dumbest of these machines, even the humble ditch digger, was smarter than any ant. Mel murmured, "So what do you make of it?" She was looking at his phone. Tash tried to reply, "Well, I can see there's a process here. Little trucks with skips being loaded up with rubble by those digger types over there. The trucks go to that complex of buildings over there, and they dump the fill into scoops at one end, and out of the other come ingots of some metal, aluminium, I guess." A whirring noise overhead. She ducked when she saw a drone, one of the cloud hovering closer under the canopy. "You're quite safe," Mel murmured. "The drones are much too smart to be any danger to the site itself or a visitor. In fact, the drones are the brains of the outfit. And its nervous system, with the transponder links they maintain between the different components, a distributed machine intelligence. You are looking at a process, yes. Look, you have machines of different specialities, miners of various sorts gathering dirt, water perhaps, which is carried to serve as feedstock for mineral extraction. Aluminium is key, but there are other valuable products to be had in the local geology. Then the extracted minerals are taken to fabricators of various kinds. One machine makes bricks for this pavement, others use aluminium to make machine parts. Still more sophisticated machines use those parts to build other machines, such as more miners or extractors or fabricators. All of it controlled and coordinated by the drones. And all powered by sunlight, by the way. There are extensive solar energy capture blankets beyond, more of which can be produced by the fabricators. And all of this is a process of which the only end goal, for now, is the laying of this pavement. But on that pavement, you see, will eventually be built another set of buildings, as you see over there, all essentially constructed from local resources. Tash remembered what Mel had told her of what she had seen on the moon, the solar energy blanket growing in the light. This was evidently some kind of extension of that technology. Not just a solar blanket, a whole installation now, growing, out of the dirt, in the sunlight. It was baffling. She should have been pre-briefed back in Government House. She said, "This is all about self-replication, isn't it? Machines that grow, reproduce." "Correct," Mel said. "Machines that can make more machines, copies of themselves, from the local resources. The theory is old. The practice is still being worked out. What I can't guess at yet is what the Chinese are going to have these smart industrial machines do. In the context of Galaxius, I mean. I'm guessing something big." Shi's phone pinged. He lifted it. "Updates from the Almirik." All of Shi's consciousness, Tash saw, was focused on his phone screen. "They just ejected the service module. After a last course adjustment burn. That's it. Nothing else they can do until they are in the atmosphere and their aerosurfaces start to work. For now, they have no more control than does a bullet fired from a gun." "How long?" Mel asked calmly. 15 minutes, she said. "That's all. Well, a lot less if the entry fails and they skip off. 15 minutes until they are down in the ocean, grinning at the helicopter crews come to pick them up. Or not." He looked at her, apparently helpless. "Longest 15 minutes of my life coming up, since Blink Day itself. And I lost Jim." Mel shepherded them both forward. "Sit in the shade, both of you. I'll fetch more drinks." She walked off to the nearest dome shelter. Shi sat on the machine-created basalt block floor, stiff in his exoskeletal aids, and he stared at his phone, the cryptic images and figures scrolling in the air above it. Mel returned from the nearest shelter with iced water, handed out glasses. Then she sat beside Shi, took a glass herself, and pulled out her own phone, evidently to track the astronaut's entry. Tash fought the impulse to get out her phone too. "All on track," Mel murmured. "The controllers are saying the guidance is perfect," she said. "On track, as best they can tell. Just 8 minutes until the blackout. They are falling headfirst into the air. The crew will be seeing brilliant light now. Beyond the windows, ionized gas, curtains of it glowing all around the lander." A long silence. Then, 1,800 kilometers downrange from the splashdown target. And there. Blackout, on time, 2 minutes, if they come through it. The ionization blocks the radio signals. Mel sighed, "We know." Shi hunched, eyes closed, rocking. Tash reached out to him, but Mel shook her head. They felt like the longest 2 minutes of Tash's own life. Then a hiss of static, a distorted voice. Shi held up his phone. Mel stared at her own phone. An aerial tracker saw them, gliding, gliding. 800 kilometers downrange, just where they should be. She tapped her phone, for audible sound. Tash heard radio voices, mostly incomprehensible, cheering in the background, and the raucous voice of some Capcom. "We got them! We got them!" Xi folded over on himself, collapsing into tears.
Oh shit!
The in-jokes crowded together, knelt beside him, held him. He stayed hunched over, unresponsive. And beyond, Tash saw the patient robots working. Pushing out this island of artifice on the ancient plain, brick by basalt brick. She thought it was the strangest thing she had ever seen, leaving aside the blink itself. Then a message came in, for her, from Fred Bowles's office. Having visited this mock-up of the moon's surface, next month Tash was to travel to the moon itself.